The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, thoughts and prayers, and Michael O'Loughlin, national correspondent for the Jesuit magazine America, discusses his recent article, How the Catholic Church Could Help Lead a Gun Control Movement. He also takes stock of Pope Francis's now five-year-old pontificate and tells why right-wing criticism of the Jesuit media star Father James Martin over his support of the LGBT community turned out to be a blessing. Back in a moment with Michael.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
41 shots, and we'll take that ride. Cross this bloody river to the other side. 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Well, is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret.
It ain't no secret.
No secret, my friend. You get killed just for living in your American skin.
41 shots.
Welcome, Michael O'Loughlin. Welcome back. But it's been too long.
Yeah, great to be here again.
Yeah. You're doing a great job from what I read here. This article especially grabbed me because it's such a lucid plan for how the Catholic Church can be relevant in a crisis, you know?
Yeah, it was an interesting experience. So I cover the Catholic Church, kind of where it is in the public square. So what's it doing in terms of news or politics? And after the horrific shooting down at the high school in Florida, I had kind of fallen into what felt like a routine. Kind of after these horrible events, these shootings, I go and, you know, look for what bishops are saying, look for what Catholic leaders are saying, put together an article about reaction, next steps, and then it goes out. And this just kept happening, you know, month after month, year after year. And I thought, you know, Catholic leaders, they say they want to take action on issues of gun violence, but what might that look like? So I decided to kind of go through some of the Catholic Church's other issues that are important to them and look at what they've done in the past in terms of political advocacy or education or even lobbying and say, well, here's an idea. Let's take different ways of engaging Catholics around the country and put it to work in the service of fighting for reduction in gun violence, fighting for stricter gun control. And, you know, as I wrote in the article at America, there's a lot of different ways that the church, through its vast education network, through its healthcare network, through its political action on Capitol Hill, that they really could come together and make a concerted effort to push for gun control. And I think we're actually starting to see some movement in that area.
You do? Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, out here in Chicago, which is a place that has suffered tremendously in terms of gun violence the last few years especially, the Archdiocese has hired someone, a former FBI agent, to lead an entire office dedicated to partnerships to reduce gun violence here in the city.
Wow.
So that's a local initiative out here, but it serves as kind of a, I think, good example of how Catholic leaders are really starting to take this issue seriously and consider how they can use their network to push for change.
Yeah, the tools are there. Maybe we can apply them in other areas than keeping gay people from marrying and keeping women from having abortions, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like some of those issues that they've been really passionate about, they have engaged in programs that definitely get people's attention. So, you know, I said, let's see if we can use some of those tactics in this area that they certainly are on board with. They just maybe haven't devoted as much time or resources to.
Mm. Right. And as a result, they just feel totally invisible on the subject, even when, to be fair, they are speaking out, but in those ways that don't get attention. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, issuing statements, it only does so much because
right.
there's so much noise around the issue. So, you know, I said symbolic actions are often more powerful. And what I did was I looked at a mass that several bishops held along the U.S.-Mexico border in 2014 to protest what they saw as harsh immigration policies. And this attracted a lot of attention because you had bishops literally distributing communion to families who were separated by a border wall.
Right.
And, you know, these images, even 4 years later now, are still very powerful, much more powerful, I think, than statements that are released regularly. So I said, what if we did something similar for gun violence, where maybe you invited families of victims of gun violence to attend a mass somewhere in a prominent place and maybe reserve spots for their family members who couldn't be there because they were killed.
Right.
I think those images would really break through the noise in more powerful ways than just the statements that come out.
Imagine. I mean, it's sad to say that the optics are that important, but they are. If you had an image of empty pews, rows upon rows of empty pews, oh, that would absolutely get a point across. And I hate to say it, but be good press for the Catholic Church.
It would. And I mean, beyond the good press, it would take a goal that I've had for years. I mean, when I was doing my research back in the late 1990s, the Catholic bishops were pushing for an eventual elimination of handguns, which would be seen as kind of a radical lefty position today.
Right.
That might show you how much the debate has changed. But they've been on board with this really strict gun control for several decades now. They just haven't been able, by either circumstances or perhaps by design, they haven't really broken through yet. Things like this could be a powerful way for church leaders to say, we are serious about this. Now let's see what we can do together.
Well, I went through your article with my handy-dandy highlighter. Why don't we go step-by-step through your proposals? Because each one of them feels like it's so worthwhile. Let's start with the 2016 anti-violence march.
Sure. So this was, again, another event in Chicago where I am, so I tend to cover a lot of Chicago events.
Mm-hmm.
But the 2016 was a particularly violent year here in Chicago in terms of gun violence. It had reached near record levels, the number of murders happening throughout the city, particularly on the south side and the west side. And at the end of the year, a local priest here, Father Michael Flager, who's also an activist, a human rights activist, social justice activist, he teamed up with several other local leaders here and said, we need to do something to show that this is not sustainable for our communities, that this level of violence is really harming our flocks, is harming the city as a whole. And what they did was, it was New Year's Eve, I believe, in 2016, so at the end of the year, they held a massive march downtown right along Michigan Avenue, which is the city's main kind of shopping thoroughfare. It's where all the high-end stores are, a very busy tourist destination, kind of like the Fifth Avenue of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
basically. And they shut the street down, and they had family members and friends and other community activists marched down the street in silence, holding white crosses written on them, the names of the people who had died that year from gun violence. So, you know, you read statistics and you read news stories about these things, and, you know, they might be impactful, but they're just numbers on the page. But when you see what's normally a very busy tourist area, when you see instead hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of white crosses being held in silence, marching from one end to the other, that kind of gets the point across that in 1 year, all these people who used to live in the city had been killed by gun violence.
Right.
And it was quiet, but it was very powerful. I was down there covering it. I interviewed some folks afterward, asked why they were there. And, you know, it was, they didn't take a lot of words, but they got their message across. And something like that on a national level could be very powerful, maybe something in the nation's capital, inviting victims, families who can't be there themselves, but to say, you know, we need to do something about this. We need to visually put a reminder on what's happening in our communities.
Right. Okay. Next.
Something else that I found interesting is this lack of research that we have about gun violence. There's a law that was passed back in 1996, a law related to guns, like so many, that was backed by the National Rifle Association. And basically what it does is it really limits, almost eliminates federal funding for research about guns.
That is so strange.
It is. And I mean, what's so interesting is back in the 70s, when we realized that cars weren't that safe, we didn't say, let's not study it. Instead, we said, let's figure out how to make them safer. And lots of federal money went into this. And eventually, the number of car crashes, of fatal car crashes, plummeted because we were able to understand the mechanics of why cars were unsafe, how to make them safer when they do crash. And, you know, we kind of got a handle on this public health issue. The same thing with smoking. Eventually, we realized that, you know, doctors should not be endorsing specific brands of cigarettes. And we put a lot of money into studying the health effects of nicotine and tobacco. And we were able to really reduce the rates of smoking. And as a result, the kind of devastating disease that's associated with long-term smoking. And these were both seen as, you know, these are public health issues that we need as a society to address and understand. Well, gun violence is... You know, thousands and thousands of people are dying every year. And the exact opposite thing has happened, though. We have the federal government saying we will not use federal money to study what's happening. And if you don't know what's happening, it's hard to take measures to address what's going on. So,
and
there is
we must point
problem.
Out, as you do in your article, that the National Rifle Association is had backed that weird legislation saying, no research, please.
It's
like saying no knowledge. No, let's not have knowledge.
Well, I mean, look, they know that the more research there is, the more the public will want to crack down on some of these egregious loopholes. And
I can't believe that even passed.
It did pass. The kind of sad thing is the original author of the bill, who's no longer in Congress, he was a Republican congressman, he's come out and said, look, this is a terrible idea. We need to have research. He said he regrets ever introducing this. But it continues to be law. And, you know, the NRA, they after every atrocious shooting like this, they kind of have their, you know, stay on message, don't give in. I think we're seeing a little bit breaking in the ranks right now after this shooting in Florida, but this law seems to, you know, it seems to stick no matter what. People kind of write articles like I did explaining it so people know what's going on, but it's been difficult to get it overturned. But what I was thinking, even though there is this law, basically it's about money, though. So there's no saying like a philanthropist, like let's just say the Gates Foundation, could devote millions of dollars to research and hire researchers to do this work. That just hasn't happened in a big way. But I was thinking that Catholic hospitals in the United States, there's about 600 of them. They all belong to a group called the Catholic Health Association, which is a hugely influential group given that one in six hospital patients in the United States is treated in a Catholic hospital every day. And this organization has taken some pretty progressive stances in recent years. It was President Obama said the Catholic Health Association was instrumental in helping to pass the Affordable Care Act back in 2010 because they kind of gave the Catholic churches go-ahead on this controversial law. And they've also been, for several years, they've been calling on Congress to do more to address the public health crisis of gun violence. So I was thinking, you know, you have all these Catholic hospitals. Many of them are in areas that are or neighborhoods that are especially, you know, harmed by gun violence. Maybe they could use some of their own resources to conduct some research. You know, who are the victims of gun violence? What's going on before someone gets to a hospital that, you know, made something escalate where a gun was present? Where are people getting guns? You could train researchers in these hospitals to really provide some valuable data that we just don't have right now, and then probably use that data to craft some either new regulations or at least give education to the public about how guns end up in these places and why they're used. That could be a really valuable contribution for the Catholic healthcare network to make to the wider discussion.
And you also add they could look into what causes conflicts to escalate to that point. And relatedly, how can we stop conflicts from escalating?
Exactly. I mean, oftentimes, you know, if a conflict escalates to that point, well, the next place someone's going to be is in a hospital emergency room.
Right.
And if you had doctors, nurses, other healthcare professionals trained to collect that data, which, you know, costs money and, you know, takes training, if you had those people on the front lines kind of trained to understand this, we might be able to figure out, you know, conflict resolution or where to put resources in terms of either law enforcement or community policing, various efforts aimed at kind of de-escalating conflict before it gets to the point where gun violence becomes an issue.
You know, it would never happen, but it's almost like it should be a question on the census.
Sure, yeah. I mean, we don't know where the guns are. That's one of the crazy things I found in this research is there's estimates that there's about 300 million guns in this country. That's almost one gun for every person. But we don't know where they are. We don't know who owns them. It's very difficult to track when they are sold privately. It's difficult to track when they're given as gifts. And it's just a huge challenge because there's such a low amount of information on this issue.
Yeah. This is a visit with Michael O'Loughlin, national correspondent for the Jesuit magazine America, about the tools Catholics can use to help solve the crisis in gun violence. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back after this.
Me, a cat, moving in with a new human. It took a little getting used to. She has these weird games she likes to play, like this giant feather. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. It's almost like she thinks I enjoy it. But seeing how much fun she gets out of it, well, I guess it makes it all worth it. Humans.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
They can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reasons do you need? Oh, 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 tell me why I don't like Monday.
Let's talk about lobbying.
Yeah, so this idea came from just the sheer numbers of Catholics in the United States. It's estimated that about 20% of the country identifies as Catholic, and of that 20%, about a third of them participate in parish life. So we're talking, you know, regardless, tens of millions of people in the United States who are going to Catholic parishes every week. And one of the ways that we could really see some movement on this is if bishops and priests, Catholic sisters, if they really encourage people at the parish level to get involved with the issue of gun violence. And, you know, one idea is that parishes could organize action days where they ask volunteers from the social justice committee to kind of recruit parishioners to either visit state capitals, write and call their lawmakers, and really just start to highlight how gun violence is affecting their local communities, even if it's anecdotally. You know, I write that there's 17,000 parishes in the United States, so even if a small fraction of them really got on board with this, it would make a big difference. And, you know, one of the examples I give is just last month in February, Catholic bishops around the country who have been really invested in making sure that so-called dreamers in the U.S., these are the kids who were brought to the United States as young children and now live here without legal documentation, so they face deportation. Well, last month, Catholic bishops asked Catholics around the country to contact lawmakers to sort of, you know, demand a fix on this because these kids are really caught in a really terrible situation. And after that effort was announced, they did a single day of, you know, calling lawmakers, and more than 45,000 calls were made. And that's not nothing. These are something that lawmakers track to see what their constituents are thinking. So I imagine something similar on gun violence would really make some noise, at least, and kind of break through to these lawmakers that people are angry about this issue and want to see action.
Right. And I think people also, parishioners, want to do something helpful, you know, really do something to help, to live out these Catholic values we supposedly have. I think
it's true, and this is a pretty, a pretty simple way in many respects. You can get a couple of folks who are eager to organize and ask them to kind of reach out to their fellow parishioners and, you know, write some letters or make some phone calls. It's a good way you can tie it to the gospel of kind of speaking up for those who can't speak for themselves.
Excellent.
And, of course, victims of gun violence often cannot.
Right. All right. The March for Life.
Yeah, this was actually an idea that a bishop came up with. So the March for Life, for the listeners who don't know, is kind of a massive rally in Washington every January. It's an anti-abortion march. It's been going on since the 1970s.
Wow.
And I highlight it because it's so big, in part because a lot of Catholic high schools and colleges give the students the day off to attend if they want.
Yeah.
They provide transportation there. They kind of subsidize lodging to make sure that everyone has a place to stay. And as a result, the numbers are really big. Tens of thousands have attended in the past. This year, President Trump spoke to the crowd. He became the first president to speak via video link. So it's a big event. It doesn't always break through in the media, but this year it did with the president speaking, of course. And I was thinking, after I heard this bishop say it, maybe there could be similar marches for other important Catholic issues. He was speaking about general kind of discord in communities, particularly around race and racial injustice. But I thought, around gun violence, too, this could be a big event. And sure enough, there's already one being planned by some of the survivors of the Florida shooting.
Right.
On March 24th. And I wonder, will bishops, Catholic bishops and Catholic priests, will they send large delegations to be part of the event? They don't
still
even have
time.
To plan it. It's already going on.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see if there's a Catholic presence there. And if not, I'll be looking at why not and then kind of exploring maybe ways that there could have been more coordination between the two groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would be a lost opportunity if they don't. I mean, maybe you can call them up.
Yeah, I'll certainly be following it. I mean, one of the interesting things, one of my colleagues at America, Colleen Dulla, she rounded up a collection of statements from Catholic universities who said that in the admissions process, they would not penalize students who were either suspended or punished in another way for skipping class to attend one of these rallies.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an encouraging sign that at least on the college level, a lot of Catholic universities are on board with these sort of protests and are encouraging high school students, don't be afraid of how this will affect your college decision. We'll support you if you decide to go attend.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, so this is maybe in some circles one of the more controversial parts of the essay. Because after every mass shooting, one of the reactions we see, especially from politicians, is taking to social media and sending thoughts and prayers to victims and their families. And I think it probably started off as a kind of good faith gesture to people who are suffering. And, people of faith do believe that prayers make a difference and
right.
They appreciate them from people even far away.
You make this disclaimer very nicely in your piece.
Yeah, and I think it's important, especially I write for a magazine, that is aimed at Catholics, and I don't want to discount, prayer. Prayer is important to, countless numbers of people. But eventually this phrase, thoughts and prayers, became something of a political tool to silence people who wanted to talk about tighter gun control that might prevent some of these shootings. It said we should be thinking and praying for these people, but it's too early to politicize the situation. And, unfortunately, I think we've seen this phrase, thoughts and prayers, as a way to kind of stop any political action. But I was thinking, maybe it's time for people of faith who have a more progressive view on gun control to really reclaim that phrase, thoughts and prayers, and, say, yes, we need to think and pray about this issue and then act on it afterward. So if Catholics, if other people of faith really wanted to spend some time thinking and praying about how to move forward, I don't think that's actually a bad thing. I think that could be a good way to kind of start this conversation and then follow it up with some of the action items that I laid out above.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you see that image, that viral photo of the check a woman wrote to her legislator? And she made it out to his campaign committee, and in the space where it said the amount, she wrote thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's a perfect example. It's kind of a meaningless phrase at this point for many people.
So, money. It seems like the church has gobs of money to throw at its favorite causes. Maybe we've touched on this a bit already, but do you feel like there is a, what do they call it, not political, but ecclesiastical will to give money toward the cause of lessening gun violence? What's your sense there?
Yeah, it's a good question with, unfortunately, I think a complicated answer. I think often Catholic money, kind of quote unquote, in the U.S. tends to be money from wealthy Catholic philanthropists who respond to a request from a bishop or a Catholic organization that really wants them to get behind an issue. So institutional money, there's not as much available for things like this, but there's a lot of Catholic philanthropy in the United States.
Yeah, the Knights of Columbus.
So, exactly, Knights of Columbus. They're able to tap into a vast donor network. You know, even at the, you know, at a diocese level or an archdiocese, they have, you know, their donors who often respond, often anonymously, to some requests for money for issues. Now, the question is there the will to that capital for gun control measures? And I think it's complicated because, you know, the reality behind all this is, yes, there are millions of Catholics in the United States. A lot of them practice their faith regularly, but they're pretty split on the gun control issue. It's not as though we're going to mobilize all these people with a single message. I think there's a lot of disagreement about this issue, just as there is in the general public. So I'm not sure that they'll be able to rally wealthy Catholics behind this issue. I'm just not sure it's a priority for many of them. But you never know. It takes one person with deep pockets to really make a difference sometimes, and that, you know, we might see that happen.
Mm-hmm. What about our Catholic legislators? Paul Ryan comes to mind. Rick Santorum. Is he still?
Yeah, he's not still around in the Senate, but he's on TV making his case. That's another, good question. I would say I don't think without substantial pressure from their voting base that much would change. I mean, we've seen on immigration that Speaker Ryan is willing to kind of go against what his bishops are asking of him. So on gun control, I don't think it'd be any different. I think it's going to have to be a really kind of ground-up movement at this point. I'm just not certain there's going to be much leadership from politicians.
You know, Mike Pence calls himself something I never heard before, but an evangelical Catholic.
Yeah, so Mike Pence grew up Catholic and kind of became an evangelical in college. He's still a practicing evangelical, but he's never quite let go of his Catholic identity, so he kind of coined this phrase, evangelical Catholic.
We digress. Have you gotten any response to this piece? Do the bishops, I know there are clerics who read America religiously, as it were. what did you hear back after this?
Yeah, I've gotten actually some good feedback. A couple of folks from different social justice ministries of archdiocese have reached out to thank me for it. I know that some bishops have been reading it. Like I said, not all this is kind of my own idea. Some of this I heard from bishops at different meetings. Mm-hmm. So I know they're thinking about it. They won't meet again as a body until June. I suspect that this will be an issue on their agenda in June. So we'll see if they kind of have taken up my call to consider how they can respond more strongly to this issue.
If you are just joining us, we're talking with Michael O'Loughlin, national correspondent for the Jesuit magazine America, about his article, How the Catholic Church Could Help Lead a Gun Control Movement. He also weighs in on how Pope Francis's 5 years in the seat of Peter have gone. among other issues. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back after this.
It's a medical breakthrough, a doctor's prescription to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't go to the pharmacy, you go to the supermarket for fruits, vegetables, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods. Side effects may include increased energy, healthy weight loss, and lower cholesterol. For a free recipe booklet, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project, committed to preventing cancer and improving survival.
Help me get some perspective vis-a-vis the bishops, because I might be a teens jaundiced. even as I'm saying this, I'm aware, because the last episode of the program that I did was about the questionable morality of drone warfare. And my guest, who was a Presbyterian minister, noted that the bishops have been really nicely out front against drone warfare. It just never crossed my radar that that was the case. And so I'm thinking I'm probably ignorant on all manner of issues that they're speaking out on. But like you say, they speak out in these arcane ways. What do you call them? Papers, letters, documents. Are they as irrelevant as I sense them to be?
This is a good question. the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is about 350, 400 bishops. They speak out on a whole lot of issues. They have different committees set up that study issues, everything from drone warfare, like you talked about, to mining regulations around the world and how they impact indigenous communities, rainforest destruction, abortion, gay marriage, some of the more high-profile kind of culture war issues. They are speaking out about things. There's a couple critiques. One is that the media, especially sort of secular media that has a whole lot to cover, they can't get too granular on just the Catholic Church, so they end up sticking to the culture war issues, which are important and certainly drive a lot of attention. So they are deserving to be covered, but some of these other things get lost in sort of the secular press. Another issue you kind of raised earlier was, well, where does the church put its resources behind? And while there may have been really thoughtful statements about drone warfare, I can tell you that there's not a lot of money behind it. So certainly it didn't break through in a way that their campaign on religious liberty, for example, has. But, you know, for me, what's been really interesting, having covered the church for several years now, is watching the bishops transition under a new presidential administration. So under the Obama administration, you had the bishops kind of in this posture of needing to defend the church's position on religious liberty around issues like contraception and abortion with the Affordable Care Act. And that kind of became, I think, unfortunately, sort of the accepted way that the church operated. They were kind of clashing with the administration over these issues. And as a result, that got a lot of media attention. That's where the church devoted a lot of its resources. That's what bishops were talking about. Well, under the Trump administration, their priorities have changed a bit. You know, now they're out front on things like immigration, on things like labor. They're actually fighting for expanded health insurance access, which is seems like a little bit of an about-face given their stance under the Obama administration. And it's just been fascinating to see kind of this energy come back into some of these other issues. There's statements coming out every week. There's some collaboration with different Catholic nonprofits between the Bishops' Conference and these nonprofits that fight for some of these more social justice-oriented issues. So as a reporter, it's just really interesting to see how, you know, an administration can really change how an institution like the Catholic Church needs to operate in the public square. So I think, you know, it might take some time, but I think we'll start to see some of these other issues really take prominence.
Wow. Thank you, President Trump.
In a way, he has certainly revitalized the Catholic left.
Right. I never thought I'd say that. Wow. Well, with our remaining time, maybe speaking of the bishops, maybe we'll shift our attention to the top bishop. Pope Francis has been pope for 5 years. Maybe it's time for a little retrospective.
So, yeah, there's a lot of sort of five-year commemorative stories out there online. There'll be a couple up at americamagazine.org where I write. I have to say, it's been an interesting 5 years. He's certainly reinvigorated the interest in the papacy. He's brought a refreshing style of leadership to the church. I recently contributed an essay to a new book called A Pope Francis Lexicon, which
oh,
is
I
short
saw a
essay.
Mention of that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great little book. It just came out last month. There's essays from a number of different Catholic leaders, like Cardinal Sean O'Malley up in Boston, different Catholic journalists, my friend Father Jim Martin, the Jesuit writer at America. I have an essay in there. And basically what they asked us to do was write a reflective essay on different words that have become associated with Pope Francis. And my word was judgment. And what I did was I kind of reflected on his quote that he made back in 2013. He was asked about gay priests and gay people in the church, and he responded simply, "Who am I to judge?" Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of become one of the hallmarks of his papacy, that he wants a less judgmental church and a church that reaches out to everyone on the margins. And I think 5 years in, we've seen him kind of insist that this is the way the church has to be, even as some of his opponents are resisting some of the changes. Now, all that being said, that's all positive and great, and I love covering it as a journalist. He's had some blind spots as well.
Yeah.
A lot of his critics have said that he's not really great with women. He kind of doesn't understand how to incorporate women more fully into the church. More recently, he's had some missteps with clerical sex abuse. I've argued from the beginning that this has been a tough issue for him to navigate, that he might not quite understand the scope of the sex abuse crisis. When he was here in the United States back in 2015, which was a great visit by most accounts, a speech he gave kind of talked about sex abuse as a problem the church needed to confront, but it didn't really go far enough, critics said, in terms of fully grasping what an impact it had here. And we saw more recently a trip to South America, again, some missteps where he doubted some victims and didn't seem to really appreciate the trauma that this clerical sex abuse scandal had brought to the church. So, 5 years in, I think he's done a lot of interesting things in terms of making the church more welcoming, but he seems to have a couple areas that maybe in the next 5 years he'll improve on. But for now, I think the critics have a good case to make.
It's puzzling because he's so bright and thoughtful and clearly spiritual. It's like, how do you not get women and sex abuse? It's pretty big.
Yeah, I mean, the woman question, he's a 80-something-year-old Argentinian priest, really. And so some people say it's just a matter of culture and that he's just not where he should be with the issue. The sex abuse question is more puzzling to me. I'm not sure I've seen a good defense of how he's handled it so far. So I think we're all still waiting to see what's actually going on there.
Didn't he say he was going to serve for 4 years and then step aside?
He didn't say step aside. This is an interview he gave early on where he said he saw himself in office for 4 or 5 years and then moving on. And the moving on was a nod to ways popes traditionally move on, which is through death. And some people in the media took that as him predicting his own death. He later clarified that he just thought that would be the case, 4 or 5 years in the job, and he'd be done. I think he was actually trying to
say the job would kill him. Basically,
that the job would kill him. No, I think he was wanting to make the case that he didn't have 30 years like John Paul II, so to kind of inject a sense of urgency into his reforms, we need to do this now because I'm not going to be around forever.
Okay, and that's.
But by all accounts, he's healthy and doing well and loves the job, so he could be around for another 5 or 10 years. We never know.
As much as I'm one of those women who wishes and wishes things would change, I do look forward to his staying in that chair because the devil you know, right?
I tend to share that view. I think there could be Possibly a kind of significant blowback after this. He definitely has some opposition. I don't think that's, I don't think everyone is on board with his agenda, so you never know what you're going to get after this.
And we're talking about opposition from within his own curia.
That's right. Some of his own advisors really don't like the direction he's taken. And I think it's because, you know, there's a lot of fear there. Things have worked for centuries a certain way. And
depending on your point of view.
Yeah. I mean, things have gone the same way for a long time. And I think by trying to shake it up, you unnerve some people.
If I have to hear one more time that the church is like a big boat that turns slowly, I just want to die.
Yeah, there's that. And then the church measures time in centuries, not years. And that's another cliche, but.
Right. Oy. You know, you mentioned your friend James Martin. He's been on my radar, actually, and I'm worried about him, you know? I know he's really, we should probably set the, give listeners the lay of the land a little bit about the controversy that erupted around or because of something he wrote. Why don't you describe it? You're so articulate.
Sure. So James Martin is a Jesuit priest and a very well-known author. He's written a number of best-selling books. His most recent book is called Building a Bridge, How the LGBT Community Can Reach Out to the Catholic Church and How the Catholic Church Can Reach Out to the LGBT Community. And Building a Bridge came out a year after the horrific shooting at Pulse Nightclub in Orlando, which was a gay nightclub in Florida. And Jim noticed that in statements of condolences from bishops, very few mentioned specifically praying for the gay community, and that bothered him. And what he did was he made a Facebook video kind of saying, you know, we should reach out to people, to communities that are affected by violence and acknowledge those communities exist. And I think a lot of Catholics really understood what he was saying and wanted to hear more. So he wrote this book kind of explaining that in his interactions with gay Catholics, that they often feel as though they aren't being heard by the church and they feel like there's no place for them. And he wrote a letter kind of challenging bishops to listen to these people and understand what they want and kind of respond as a pastor would. And at the same time, the second half of the book, which doesn't get as much coverage, is gay Catholics, they might kind of try to understand where the bishops are coming from. Understand the history, and it's a very kind of, I think, balanced and fair challenge to both sides.
Very even-minded. It was astonishing to me when it caused such a furor. It's like, wait, he's saying such helpful things that people on both sides can do to bridge this gap. And no one would deny that there is a terrible chasm between the gay community and the Catholic Church, and it's understandable. The church thinks gays shouldn't really even be allowed to express their sexuality, except, well, at all, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, and you're right, there's been a huge blowback from sort of the right wing of the Catholic Church. They've been very upset about this book. He's been facing a lot of pressure from kind of online mobs who have reached out to institutions that are hosting talks of his, and they've been canceled. Just a lot of hateful stuff
here
written
in
online
Connecticut.
On social media. Yeah. That's right, exactly. Father Jim, I mean, he's kind of forging ahead. The new edition of the book just came out, which includes a lot of updates from things you've learned over the past year giving talks. You know, what I always think is most telling is that when he goes to these parishes, it's always kind of standing room only. They're sold out. People want to hear this message. And, you know, online, it's, I think, a very loud but pretty small group of people who really take issue with this.
You are listening to a chat with America Magazine national correspondent Michael O'Loughlin, talking about, among other things, gun violence, the limits of thoughts and prayers, and Pope Francis's pluses and minuses as he hits his 5-year anniversary as pontiff. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back after this.
What if it wasn't always about getting ahead? What if you didn't care about being on the fast track? What if your career goals were to change? Instead of flying off to the big interview, what if you flew somewhere else altogether? To embark on a different track? To volunteer in ways you never dreamed of? In places you never imagined yourself being? Like a tiny island in the Pacific, barely visible on a map, but where needs are easy to see. Or a village on the African continent, where just a little training in HIV awareness can change the fate of thousands. What if you decided to share your skills with others and help someone else get ahead? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
I don't know. It shouldn't be that rare for there to be priests like that, you know? And at the outset of our conversation today, you mentioned an activist priest in Chicago. Tell me his name again.
Michael Flager. He's kind of a fixture on the Chicago social justice scene. He's been around for decades. The march that we talked about, he was marching with Jesse Jackson. So he's a fixture on sort of the civil rights issues here in Chicago. I don't know if you remember a movie that came out a few years ago called Chirac about gun violence here. There's a white Roman Catholic priest in that movie who's actually depicting Michael Flager, who's very prominent and popular in the African American community here.
Wow. Well, you know, there used to be Catholic personages, Catholic spokesmen for the progressive view of the gospel, you know?
And oh, yeah, for sure.
Where have they gone, you know? I mean, the closest we get, and he's not a cleric, but he's Catholic and he's proud of it. He carries a rosary in his pocket, is Joe Biden.
Oh, sure, yeah, there's Joe Biden. I mean, there's Stephen Colbert, who's certainly taken a progressive stance the last few years. Just finished reading a great book by Cardinal Joseph Bernardine, who was an archbishop here in Chicago, called The Gift of Peace. He was a big kind of Catholic progressive leader back in the 90s.
Right.
And what's been interesting to me, Cardinal Blaise Cupich, who's the Archbishop now here in Chicago, he's really taken up Cardinal Bernardine's mantle of progressivism. And I think he's someone to watch. He is, only a couple of years into the job, but he's certainly become a leader on the Catholic progressive social justice side. So I think the voices are starting to emerge. And like I said, with, you know, kind of the times with the Trump administration, with Pope Francis, I think we can look for a little bit of a resurgence of kind of Catholic progressivism.
Oh, from your mouth to God's ears. That would be so great. I want to see them on TV. I want them to have a cable presence, you know. You know what? Chris Matthews is another name. Now and then he will drop that, you know, growing up Catholic or his Catholic faith. He has a really nice take on being pro-life in the best possible way, you know.
Sure.
So, I don't know. Huh. I'm going to cling to your optimistic view.
Well, we'll see what happens. We'll check in a year from now and see if I was right.
I would love that. That would be great. Is there anything on your radar right now? We have a few minutes left that you feel you'd like to conclude with? Do you get to Rome?
I do get to Rome occasionally. I'll be headed back this fall. There'll be a big global meeting about the Catholic Church and young adults. And this is a synod of bishops, so it's a meeting of bishops from around the world. And Pope Francis has said, you know, we need to hear directly from young adults. We can't be talking at them. We can't be telling them what they need to hear. We need to listen. And that's what this meeting is designed for, to invite young people from around the world to come and speak to bishops to explain why they are involved in the church or why they're not. The Pope said we need to reach out to all kinds of communities, Baptist Catholics, atheists, non-Catholic young adults, just to kind of hear what's going on in the world. So That would be a really good chance for me to kind of be back in Rome to understand, you know, what's happening with the Vatican, which is always an interesting place.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah.
It's like that Chinese curse, right? May you live in interesting times.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, how will that event differ from previous big youth events, you know, where people just adore the Pope and it's pretty pretty single-minded on that front?
Yeah, so things like World Youth Day, for example, millions of Catholics come together for, you know, a few days of prayer and kind of socializing and fellowship, and then, you know, that's kind of the point of the event. This is a little different because these events are held just every 3 years with bishops, and they cover different topics, and sometimes they're really important because some of the Pope's more controversial teachings about the family actually came out of a similar event that was held back in 2014 and 2015. This is his letter on family life, The Joy of Family. And that really kind of changed some of the church's pastoral practices. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, if young people come with an overwhelming desire to see some change in the church after, you know, publicly speaking about this to bishops and the Pope, it'll be hard for that to be ignored. So we'll have to see, you know, who was picked to go over, what they said, and then, you know, the Pope's in charge. So if he hears something he likes and wants to change something in the church, it could happen.
Your mention of who gets picked to go over reminds me of the Vatican's crossing three names off a list. You're familiar with this? The women whose participation was objected to by the bishops to the point where the whole event for International Women's Day had to be relocated outside the Vatican walls. I mean, was that as black an eye as it seems to me for the Vatican?
It's an odd story. So this is an event that's been held every year for the past few years on International Women's Day. It's been held inside the Vatican, where Catholic women from around the world come and kind of speak about, you know, women in the church. This is something we talked about with the Pope before.
Right.
It's been done without controversy. One of the compromises has been that the group will not talk about women's ordination.
Right.
That's kind of been a compromise on both sides. This year, one of their keynote speakers was Mary McAleese, the former president of Ireland. And she is...
Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's kind of taken her faith seriously. She's studying theology after she left office. But she's also been very outspoken on the need to include women more fully in the church, including ordination. And I think the church was church authorities were uneasy with that and kind of said, let's not go this route. And organizers, I know in the past, have actually worked with them to settle the list of speakers. And there have been compromises in the past. I think this year, they felt a little more bold and said, no, we are going to have these women speak, so we'll just take the event off-site. It certainly got the group headlines and got people talking, so discussion, I think, is always good.
Well, this discussion was good. Thank you, Michael O'Loughlin. This was really fun, and I look forward to our next visit.
Sounds good. Thank you.
That was a visit with Michael O'Loughlin, national correspondent for the Jesuit magazine America, about gun violence, Pope Francis's fifth anniversary, and why right-wing criticism of the media celebrity Father James Martin was good for the cause of LGBT equality. If you missed any of the episode, you can find it archived later tonight at reasonablycatholic.com. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for 3 hours of Acoustic Blender with Bill Revel.